I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opiongo Line, a podcast dedicated to bringing you the best of our very own local heritage and unique culture here in the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River Valleys in Eastern Ontario, Canada. I know you haven't heard anything new from us for a while, and a few of you may have thought we might even have given up the ghost, or at best gone AWOL. Truth be told, we were on a break, a summer holiday, if you will. The powers that be thought that after watching us slog through the worst of COVID, producing 120 shows over the past 4 years, we could use a wee bit of a break to recharge our batteries, so to speak. So, we did just that. And now we're back, rested and raring to go. And this week, we've got something thoroughly informative and wildly entertaining. During our holiday, the Opiongo Readers Theatre organized a spanking new group of readers down among the good people who run the Bonnechere Museum. And last Saturday night, they gave their first live performance at the Royal Canadian Legion in downtown Neganville, home of that Bonnechere Museum, or as we like to call it, the jewel of the Bonnechere. Now, for those of you out there in the World Wide Web and perhaps living under a rock and who may not know where Eganville is located, it's not on the Madawaska nor Opiongo Rivers, not even the York nor the Little Mississippi. Rather, it's on the Bonnechere River, over there, across the Wilno Hills, in its very own rich and vibrant valley, a sort of alter ego to those of us here along the Madawaska and Opiongo River valleys. And though much of our local culture and heritage is intertwined with the Bonnechere, there's enough of a difference to make it more than just a little interesting. So let's give a listen to their first show, aptly entitled Bounty of the Bonnechere.
Hello, my name is Kayla Desjardins, Chair of the Bonnechere Museum, and I'd like to welcome you here today to what may soon be talked of as a night to remember. With me today are four members of our newly formed Eganville chapter of the Opiongo Readers Theatre: Gerald Priestley, Jack Rosine, Ben Searson, and Blake Tubby. Undoubtedly, it will be an evening where you will learn some new things about 19th century Eganville and the Bonnechere Valley. Strange, wonderful, tragic, comedic things. Things about some very unique local characters and historical events that made this place what it is today. Things that you may not want to believe. And we're not even talking about those wild and crazy events that happened in the 20th century. Eganville just has too much fascinating local history to get that far into recent past. No, for the next hour or so, we're going to take a long, hard look at what your grandkids call ancient history. We're going to focus only on some of the strangest, most curious goings-on in and around Eganville, and all dealing with people and events that happened long before the 20th century even began. So let us begin. No doubt you have all heard that the Algonquins inhabited the Bonnechere for 8,000 years prior to any Europeans ever showing up. Though we do still keep shrewd eye out for stories about Vikings who sometimes have a nasty way of showing up. Sort of like the Spanish Inquisition in those old Monty Python sketches in late 20th century TV, when you least expect them. But I digress. We will stick to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the local historical truth, and that we currently know about and can prove. The real story of those European settlers who came to Eganville with what might seem like an extraordinary sounding place, the Isle of Mull, which turns out was just off the west coast of Scotland. It was there in 1820, two young fellows, John McLean and John Lorne McDougall, decided to beat a path across the Western Ocean towards Montreal, where they hoped to try their luck working for the Hudson Bay Company. So in the spring of 1821, John McLean and John Lorne McDougall began afresh in what was then British North America. As two inexperienced fur trading clerks, they served out their apprenticeship at Lake of Two Mountains. Lake of Two Mountains, it will be remembered, is located at the mouth of the Ottawa River, where it pours into the St. Lawrence River. 2 years later, in 1823, John McLean, all by himself, made his way up the Ottawa River to take over Hudson Bay Company operations near Fitzroy Harbor. And 2 years after that, in 1825, he was again shuffled off further west, this time to Hudson Bay Post at Fort Collonge. Fort Collonge, as many of you know, sits in what now is Pontiac County, Quebec. It looks across the Ottawa to what we would eventually become Renfrew County, Ontario. And so near the end of 1825, John McLean decided to venture forth across the mighty Ottawa. He wanted to establish a new Hudson Bay outpost in the very heart of the Bonnechere River Valley at a place called Golden Lake. McLean knew enough French to know that Bonnechere meant the good river. That positive judgment was afforded the Bonnechere in an effort, perhaps, to separate it from that devilish other bad river, the Madawaska, with its many horrific twists and turns and 29 bone-crushing rapids and waterfalls. The Bonnechere, John McLean figured, would be a much easier place to work his developing fur trade, given that between the Bonnechere's mouth, which poured into the Ottawa River at what would become Castleford, and where the town of Eganville would eventually be established, there were only 5 chutes, or waterfalls, to worry about. 2 down near what would become Renfrew, 2 near what would become Douglas, and a 5th chute here where Eganville would eventually spring forth. But first, something to know how John McLean got Golden Lake late in 1825 as winter set in. He described that expedition in his own 2-volume autobiography published in 1849.
The Iroquois passed early in spring with 18 Indian packs in their canoes. Each pack might be estimated at 60 pounds sterling. Our other opponents started for Montreal about the same time as last year, and I was ordered down to Fort Coulonge to take Mr. Silverite's place for the summer. He returned from Montreal about the end of August, and I was much gratified to learn from him that I had been again appointed to the charge of the shats, so that all the merit or demerit of good or bad management would now be entirely my own. A few days after, a middle-sized canoe arrived, manned by 3 Canadians, with whom I embarked for the scene of my first essay as an Indian trader. On arriving at the post, I was surprised to find an old Canadian and his cara esposa, dear wife, in possession, a circumstance of which I had no previous intimation. This worthy pair seemed determined to maintain their position in defiance of me, and not wishing to employ violent means to dispossess them, if it could possibly be done otherwise, I passed the night in the hall. Having, however, obtained possession of the outworks, I was determined to carry the citadel, and, summoning the contumacious occupants into my presence next morning, I demanded, in a peremptory tone, the immediate surrender of the keys. "Show me your authority," said he. "If I do not show it, you shall soon feel it presently," I replied. Seeing that, I ordered my men to put my threat into execution. Jean-Baptiste assumed a more humble attitude and requested me as a favor to permit him to remain in the kitchen until he could find a passage to Montreal. With this request, I willingly complied. My old opponent had still a post in this district, and I was directed to send a party in opposition to him, which, being done, I remained quiet until the winter communication became practicable, when I determined on paying a visit to my friends in the Fort Coulonge district. The distance being short, and my object having no connection with the company's interests, I set off on my pleasure jaunt alone. I put up the first night at a sort of tavern, just then opened by an American, at the upper end of the Shats Lake, the only habitation at that time in the quarter, whence I started at early dawn, expecting to reach Fort Coulonge before night. The lumbermen having commenced sledging their winter supplies, the road formed by these vehicles presented a hard, smooth surface on which I made good speed, as I had nothing to encumber me save my blanket and tomahawk. Arriving at a long bend of the river about 2 p.m., I put on my snowshoes to cut across the point and meet the road again, flattering myself that I should thus shorten the distance some 2 or 3 miles. The weather being mild and the sun overcast, I was as much at a loss to find my way in the woods as if I had been blindfolded. I nevertheless continued my onward course and again came on the road. I proceeded in high spirits for a considerable time when I perceived a man before me going in the same direction. Quickening my pace, I soon came up with him and asked him if he was bound for the fort. "I guess I don't know of any fort in this part of the world," said he. "What, not know of Fort Coulonge, and you so near to it? Are you not going there?" "I have heard of such a place," said Jonathan, "but I take a tarnation long time to get to it, I calculate, if I followed my nose as it points now." I told him who I was, whither bound, and where I slept last night. "I guess, then, you'd better sleep there again, for it's not quite 3 miles off." This was the result of making a shortcut, and I resolved to follow the long and sure road in future. A shanty that had been recently occupied afforded me comfortable lodgings for the night, and I arrived at Fort Coulonge about noon next day, where I passed the night and started for the outpost. Here I remained 2 days, and would have remained still longer had it not been discovered one morning that our opponents were off in the direction of my outpost on the Bonnechere. As the Indians in that quarter were excellent hunters and owed me much, I deemed it advisable to follow them. My friends, too, sent an interpreter and 3 men along with me for the purpose of trading what they could on account of their own post. Chacun pour soi, every man for himself, being the order of the day. We soon overtook our opponents, and I resolved, if possible, to give them the slip by the way. Accordingly, when within a day's journey of the establishment, I pretended to have sprained my foot so badly that I walked with the greatest seeming difficulty. My men, who were aware of the ruse, requested me to place my bundle on their sledges to enable me to keep up with them. This farce commenced in the evening. Next morning, my leg was worse than ever, until we came on the river at about 10 miles distance from the post. I was delighted to find but little snow upon the ice, so that I had a fair opportunity of putting the mettle of my legs to the test, and the opposition party having sledges heavily laden, I walked hard, my foot on a sudden becoming perfectly sound, in order to tire them as much as possible before I bolted. Having apparently effected my purpose, I set off at the top of my speed, and never looked behind me until I had cleared the first long reach, when, turning round, I saw a man in pursuit about halfway across. I started again and saw no more of my pursuer. On arriving at the post, I was gratified to learn that the Indians, whom I was so anxious about, had been in a few days previously, while our opponents were off in another direction, so that they had been seen by none save our own people. Finding 2 men at home, I proceeded with them to the Indian camp and arrived at dawn of the day. I met with a friendly reception and had the good fortune to prevail upon the Indians to deliver me their furs upon the spot, which formed a very heavy load for both myself and men. We met our opponents in returning, but though they had ocular proof of my success, they nevertheless went on to the camp. Having arrived at the post, I found some Indians there all intoxicated. I was also mortified to find the person in charge in the same state. I immediately displaced him and made over the charge pro tempore, for the time being, to one of the men. The conduct of my worthless deputy hurt me so much that I could not remain another night under the same roof with him. I therefore set off on my return to Shatt's, although already late in the afternoon, expecting to reach the first shanty in the early part of night. The Bonnechere River is very rapid in the upper part, and does not set fast, freeze, until late in the season, unless the cold be very intense. I arrived at this part soon after nightfall, and perceiving by the clear light of the moon the dangers in my way, I deemed it imprudent to proceed farther, and having nothing to strike fire with, I cut a few branches of balsam and strewed them under the spreading boughs of a large cedar, and, wrapping myself up in my blanket, lay down. The weather being mild, I thought I could sleep comfortably without fire, but I was mistaken. When I awoke from my first sleep, which must have been sound, I found my limbs stiff with cold, while my teeth chattered violently in my head. To remain in this condition till daylight was almost certain death. I resolved, therefore, at all hazards, to find my way to the shanty, which might be about 10 miles distant. The light of the moon being very bright enabled me to avoid the openings in the ice, and, by moving on cautiously, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I reached the shanty, which belonged to a warm-hearted son of Erin, who received me with the characteristic hospitality of his countrymen, placing before me the best his cabin afforded, and with his own blankets and those of his men, making up a comfortable bed, on which I slept till late in the day, and all the next. As the greater part of my customers wintered in the vicinity of the outpost, and I had no longer any confidence in the person in charge there, I resolved on passing the remainder of the winter at it myself. I therefore requested that a person should be sent up from the Lake of Two Mountains to take care of the establishment during my absence. On the arrival of this person, I proceeded to the outpost, but shall pass over the transactions that occurred there, being similar in all respects to those already narrated. One circumstance, however, occurred, which, though not in my vocation, I think worthy of notice. 2 itinerant missionaries called at the Lake of Two Mountains and distributed a number of religious tracts among the natives, together with a few copies of the Gospel according to St. John in the Indian language. My Algonquin interpreter happened to get one of the latter and took much pleasure in reading it. Towards the latter end of the season, I received a packet from my superior at the lake, and, to my surprise, found in it a letter with the seal of the church affixed, addressed to my interpreter, which I put into his hands and observed him perusing very attentively. Soon after, he called me aside and told me that the letter in question conveyed a peremptory command from the priest to destroy the bad book he had in his possession, or else his child, that died in the autumn, would be denied the rites of Christian sepulture. We are told that the age of bigotry is past. Facts like this prove the contrary. I asked him if he intended to obey the commands of his ghostly father. "Not exactly," said he. "I shall send the book to him and let him do with it what he pleases. For my part, I have read it over and over again and find it all good, very good. Why the black coat should call it bad is a mystery to me."
But what of John McLean's original good friend, John Lord McDougall? He took over McLean's Golden Lake Outpost in 1837, but McDougall's career at Hudson Bay Company ended abruptly about 10 years later, thanks to the famous Franklin Expedition. Here's what was said about that misadventure. It's taken from a February 2nd, 1948 edition of the Ottawa Journal.
"It was a night in 1821 at the Hudson's Bay Post on Lake of Two Mountains. Two Scotch youths were watching for the arrival of Indian canoes at the landing place. In youthful fancy, they had often pictured such a Canadian scene and the adventure of which they had now embarked. But all that seemed long ago on their home island of Mull, where the Atlantic surges crashed on the rocky shore and where curlews screamed among the crags of Ben Mor. Mull, shrouded in mist, was now a closed chapter in the lives of John McLean and John Lorne McDougall. Both had entered the service of the Hudson's Bay Company together, having left Scotland in 1820. After a brief apprenticeship in Montreal in the spring of 1821, both had then been appointed clerks at the Lake of Two Mountains post on the Ottawa. The post was commanded by Alexander Fisher, an old Indian trader from the Kingston. And when McDougall and McLean arrived, the spring run was about to commence. This meant that the flotillas of Indian canoes, with their cargoes of beaver peltries, would do almost any time. As the Indians generally arrived at night, the staff of the post sat up in shifts, watching for the first canoes. As soon as these arrived, the chief of the post was informed and immediately hastened to meet them on the landing, for other competing traders were also on the alert, with the same objective. Thus were McLean and McDougall introduced to the life of an Indian trader, an occupation they both pursued all through the Ottawa Valley, undergoing all manner of hardships, enduring fatigue, facing danger, and counting it all part of the great game of life. After a winter at Lake of Two Mountains, McLean and McDougall were separated. McLean left to become bourgeois, or chief trader, of the fort at the Shats, where a few years later his friend, McDougall, succeeded him. The trials of both men crossed and recrossed in all that wilderness of the lower and upper Ottawa Valley, and the friendship remained unbroken to the end. McDougall, in 1837, left the Shats to become the bourgeois of Gordon Lake, but his greatest claim to the Hudson's Bay Company's gratitude was his long and rapid journey from Montreal to Lake Superior. According to the story of that exploit, as related to us, it seems that among the many parties in the Arctic searching for the survivors of the ill-fated Franklin expedition was one composed of Hudson's Bay men. This rescue party itself was reported lost, and the company had instructed a second party to locate the first when news was received that the first party had made its way safely to civilization. Thus, the second party had to be stopped. Cancellation orders were issued, and J. Lorne MacDonald was entrusted to carry this emergent message on its first stage to Lake Superior, where it was to be further relayed to its ultimate destination. Eventually, McDougall felt that his services in this matter had not been properly appreciated by the Hudson's Bay Company, and so he resigned. Seeking a fresh start, and after nearly 10 years at Golden Lake, he decided upon settlement in the then pioneer hamlet of Renfrew. He was Renfrew's first storekeeper, and that store was located at the north end of what is now Main Street. His first house in Renfrew was on the site of property later purchased by the late Ned McKay, and is now a Catholic girls' school. He left that place to his son, who had become Canada's longest-serving Auditor General, and who had been born in Gordon Lake in 1838. The old fur trader's second house, constructed on adjacent property to his first, and built along more spacious proportions, it once contained a ballroom famous throughout the countryside for McDougall's hospitality. It was a tradition in the entire district. The old Hudson's Bay men acquired 4,000 acres in a power site at Renfrew, at what the old-timers called the Second Chute, and where McDougall built Renfrew's first gristmill. In fact, it is said that the village narrowly missed being called Lorneville. Because of Scotch contrariness, probably, The very idea of naming the town as such was flouted when certain dour Highland burghers declared that they wouldna live in a town named after yon Hudson Bay mun. Later, in 1858, they finally recognized the old Gordon Lake fur trader's worth and elected him to Parliament. It is also related that in the famine year, in the middle 1850s, old John McDougall supplied many settlers in the backcountry with free flour. An old settler of Mount St. Patrick once recalled how generously the old fur trader had treated his father and others in that terrible winter. McDougall's natural leadership made him prominent in the community. He was apparently one of Renfrew's first early magistrates. In this capacity, he once fined a number of rioting shantymen and applied fines towards the building of a bridge across the Bonnishire to serve the growing community. In the fullness of years in service, McDougall died in 1860 and was interred in Renfrew's pioneer burying ground on Lawhill Street. When that property was purchased for a separate school, the bodies of all the forefathers of the hamlet were reinterred in the present cemetery on Thompson Hill. Thus, a lad from the Isle of Mull came to a new country, helped materially in its development, and reached his journey's end by the banks of the Singing River, honored in the chansons of brave breed as the Bonnishire.
John McDougall's real claim to fame involves his son, J. Lauren McDougall Jr., who was born in Golden Lake in 1838. He went on to a distinguished political career, appointed as Canada's first Auditor General. He would eventually work for seven different Canadian prime ministers, from Sir John A. Macdonald right up to Sir Wilfrid Laurier. Finally, there's the last Hudson Bay fur trader who was posted to Golden Lake in those mystical days in the first half of the 19th century. His name was Charles, or less formally, Charlie Thomas. He arrived at Golden Lake sometime between 1830 and 1832. Eventually, he took over from McDougall as the last Hudson Bay Company agent at that Golden Lake outpost, it is believed sometime in the late 1840s. Shortly after Thomas took over as this lone agent, the Hudson Bay Company ceased operations at Golden Lake. To be fair, by that time, Charlie had reinvented both that Hudson Bay post and himself. They both took on a newer, if not fresher, more vibrant role in the Bonnishire River Valley. Known by hundreds, if not thousands, of timber cruisers and shanty teamsters alike, Charlie Thomas, by the late 1840s, ran his own Golden Lake depot full tilt. Day by day, month by month, after John Lorne McDougall had left Golden Lake, it became less of a Hudson Bay fur trading outpost. It became more and more a timber cruiser stopping place. In fact, everybody up and down the Ottawa Valley knew it simply as Charlie's Hope. Long before Canadian Confederation, and as far away as Montreal, Charlie's Hope became a much-loved and well-oiled tavern, if not overnight shebeen, for anyone who chose to stay there, especially on a cold winter's night. Rowdy teamsters and ruckus timber cruisers were always welcome to stop on their way up or down the Bonnishire, Madawaska, Opiongo, and York River valleys, going to either to or from what would eventually become Algonquin Park. But back in the middle of the 19th century, that Algonquin frontier was simply known as the world's most hectic timber district, and Charlie's Hope was right smack dab in the middle of it all. Who wouldn't want to stop there? Charlie Thomas was quite simply a character. One only has to read his journal of transactions and occurrences at Charlie's Hope to know that to be true in spades. How could he not be? A very well-traveled and very well-read fellow, Charlie Thomas was the son of a Hudson Bay Company factor and Indigenous Cree. He was born in 1793 at Moose Factory along James Bay. He grew up in the fur trading traditions of the Great Company and was privately schooled in England. Long before he came to Golden Lake, Charlie Thomas traded furs in northern British Columbia in the far west and had also done so as far as east as New Brunswick. Most of all, he knew how to keep meticulous, if sometimes curious, notes of the daily comings and goings at his outpost on Golden Lake. To this day, his mid-19th century observations about Canadian frontier life are still studied by historians and social scientists worldwide. For example, here are a few choice bits from his 1850 to 1852 journal.
1850, January 1st, Thursday, New Year's Day. A beautiful, clear, frosty day throughout. Mr. Perigo and wife took dinner with us on their way downwards to Fairfield. After the dinner, the family, in toto, made Charles and Betsy a visit, taking old Pierce, who came up with Tommy and wife yesterday, to give them a tune on the fiddle. At night, we had quite a thronged house of dancing Algonquins. January 27th, Monday. Easterly and southeasterly wind. Rather a fine, though cold, day. I assisted Cole McDonald's clerk, the doctor, to weigh two loads of hay for Charles, who is at the mill. Considerable number of shanty teams passing up and down again, and we had a few span at night. Charles Colt killed a calf in play. I received a small keg, a few gallons of brandy, from Aylmer, from one of John Egan's teams. Archie, the bagpiper, headed up for Egan's limit. January 29th, Wednesday. It blew and snowed most of all last night. The teams here the greatest part of the morning, as the weather was dreadful at night. We had five spans of horses, Egan contractors and McGibbons. Awfully cold and stormy towards night, worse than ever. January 30th, Thursday. A most excessive cold and stormy night. All the loaded teams unloaded and returned homewards. Cole McDonald arrived at 10 a.m., stayed for dinner, and then went back across Golden Lake. Teams going downwards all day. William Byers took dinner and then went on again. We had five span of horses stay with us overnight. January 31st, Friday. Still cold, but no wind. Roads rather heavy. Cole McDonald sending down four teams to draw up hay. We cleared away some snow from the doors. At night, we had Ned McCabe and Old Fulford from the York River, and Martin Wright and the two young Edwards from Little Lake Dory. Billy Pierce brought up Tommy's horses, as he had cut himself. February 1st, Saturday. Easterly wind and cloudy. Still cold. Charles brought up some bran and some things belonging to Old Pellerin, and then we went to the nets and brought upwards of 40 sundry kinds of fish. Cole and the doctor took dinner and arranged matters with Charles, and then went off down. Very little teaming, as the roads are bad. Alec drew wood in the afternoon with Tommy's horses and Nick. At night, we had five spans stay, three out of William Byers' shanty, and the others from Price and McFarland's. Joe Price on a great spree and very sick. February 3rd, Monday. Cloudy and more mild. Charles with black and white team, the double team, went for hay to Brennan's Creek Wild Meadows. They brought back two very small loads, as the roads are bad. Mr. Bangs arrived, and I sold him the few furs I had. He remained the rest of the day. We had Mr. Hickey at night, and some of his teams. Tommy and Edward came to see us about things. February 7th, Friday. Cold but fine day. The nets were seen, but few fish. At night, we had 14 span of horses. Richard McCarl and family came down from the lower Bonachere, mostly Wadsworth and Lockie teams. Also, Mr. Hickey came down. February 10th, Monday. More snow fell last night, but mild. Our teams and lodging slow in starting. Heavy snow all day. A wedding party arrived during the snowstorm and took up their quarters with us all night. Some dancing and a little drinking. LeBlanc was here also and partook of the sport. Two loads of wild hay taken down to Charles and a small load of tame hay brought up here. February 11th, Tuesday. The snow continued most of last night, but ceased before morning. Mild and no wind. The wedding party after breakfast divided up. Perigo and Payette, with the women, went home upwards, and the rest returned. The going was dreadful. Deep snow, and in some places, water. About noon, we had a visit from Alex McDonald Esquire with Lady and Son. The latter two remained with us, and the former went over to his shanties. Very cold night. February 12th, Wednesday. About noon, Mr. Alex McDonald came and took away his Lady and Son. The weather much milder. We had Cole McDonald at night, and about seven span at night. Charles gave us two loads of hay. February 13th, Thursday. Very mild day. Charles and Black Baptiste fetched over the last of the wild hay, and Alec took down a load of wild hay to Tommy. Great traveling on lake, but abominable bad roads. We had 14 span stay last night. Cole McDonald here again. February 14th, Friday. Mizzling rainy morning and day. Cole McDonald went down. Alec came up in the morning. Awful state of roads. Nine spans stayed last night. February 19th, Wednesday. Fine day. Received a visit en passant from Sillery of Fairfield. About one dozen teams went up for Perigo's. We had Rory's 4 hay teams at night, and Peter Campbell and LePan, 6 spans in all. Tommy, along with Rory's men. Old Pissandois and old Igneous and young Igneous and Montroy started today for hunting excursion. Paul still very bad. April 26th, Saturday. It froze hard last night, a calm morning which continued throughout the day. Charles brought an otter he has taken in Coram Creek for us to skin and stretch. Hickey took dinner with his 2 men, also a few glasses, and I delivered my account in toto, and he continued on downwards for Fairfield. Alex drew some dung with Nick. July 12th, Monday. A fine, cool day. Black Baptiste and Alec slashed down one little meadow, which is this year very poor, and headed up in stocks by night. Their mother is still doing very poorly. Early in the morning, the sound of cannon was heard in the direction of Pembroke, supposed fired by the Orange Party, celebrating the 12th and their Orange anniversary.
If you're skeptical about whether Charlie Thomas was able to hear those strident Orange men in Pembroke, some 37 kilometers away from Golden Lake, we'll wait until you hear about another strange summer night here in Eganville. In August 1894, J.R. Booth's humongous multi-million dollar lumber yard totally went up in flames in the west end of Ottawa, a whopping 101 kilometers away from Eganville. The village folk here swore up and down that they were kept up half the night, all standing around, wondering what in tarnation were those shimmering slashes of flickering red rising high up in the dark eastern sky. It was not until 2 local newspapers, the Eganville Enterprise and the Eganville Star, told them about the fire that went down in Ottawa that they figured it all out. But what of Eganville back in the 1820s and 30s? Well, if Golden Lake had 3 founding European fur trading fathers, solid Hudson Bay Company men, then Eganville also had 3 founding lumberman fathers, Gregory Boulanger, James Wadsworth, and John Egan. It was Monsieur Boulanger who first arrived at the Bonnechere River's 5th chute around the same time as John McLean was setting up shop at Golden Lake. Apparently it was Boulanger, an intrepid French-Canadian timber cruiser turned squatter who was the first European to chop down a tree at that very place that would become Eganville. He built a log shanty just west of what would become the CPR freight shed west of town. But little else is known of him with any certainty. He remains pretty much a mythical figure, a faceless fellow who cleared a few acres to make way for some surrounding farmland, but he didn't even bother to name the place. Years later, Monsieur Boulanger's simple clearing would become known as the Donny or Dion Place. Truly, it wasn't until a year later, in 1826, when Boulanger sold his whole kit and caboodle to James Wadsworth, that Eganville, the jewel of the Bonnechere, was nurtured into being. It was James Wadsworth who finally named that virgin piece of squatter property New Fairfield Farm, and we have the proof. On a good day, Charlie Thomas wrote about it as Fairfields, and on a bad day, simply the farm. Still, it is with James Wadsworth that the real story of Eganville gets underway. But again, it's a story that starts across the Atlantic, this time in Ireland, where James Wadsworth was born in 1804. At the tender age of 16, he immigrated to British North America around the same time as the 2 Johns had left the Isle of Mull in Scotland and ended up lounging around Lake of Two Mountains, learning the fur trade business. But as it turns out, James Wadsworth began exploring the Ottawa River long before McLean or McDougall. In early 1822, James Wadsworth went exploring westward along the Ottawa beyond Calumet Island. Wadsworth's job was to harvest square timber along the riverbanks that separated what would become Pontiac County from Renfrew County. In fact, it was James Wadsworth who would be the first European to bring a timber raft down the Ottawa from above Calumet and successfully get it through all those chutes and whitewater rapids below and eventually on to Quebec City for export to England. In a phrase, James Wadsworth was no ordinary timberjack. By 1826, he had moved up the Bonnechere River to his new Fairfield farm, and from there, over the next 10 years, he continued to build an impressive frontier reputation. Between 1828 and 1836, the British Crown paid him nearly £10,000 sterling to build all the timber slides and control dams between the Bonnechere River's first chute near Castleford, which incidentally would get in 1832 the Bonnechere's first post office, and the 5th chute where the village of Eganville would be built eventually. Indeed, without those initial river works, that Johnny-come-lately, John Egan, would not likely have achieved the success and acclaim he eventually earned in Eganville, or elsewhere for that matter. And even though most local and national historians only give James Wadsworth a passing nod, we think he deserves a closer look, if only because the true story of his doings in Eganville have largely remained hidden for nearly 200 years. For instance, as it turns out, back in 1828, 24-year-old James Wadsworth canoodling got him caught up in one of the longest-running court battles in Canadian legal history. It all started shortly after Wadsworth set himself up on his new Fairfield farm. He had just signed another employment contract to deliver another timber raft to Quebec City for a certain Mr. McCullen. Only poor Mr. McCullen gave up the ghost and left his young wife a widow before that contract was completed and paid out. The rest, as they say, is history, but all its amazing details can still be found in one very old 1893 British Privy Council court case book.
James Wadsworth, a laboring man in the employ of a lumberer named McMullen, whose chief seat of operation was on the River Bonnechere in Upper Canada, was in the habit of assisting to take down his employer's rafts to Quebec. McMullen, having died in the year in question, 1828, Wadsworth had charge of the raft of the season to Quebec. There he met his employer's widow, Mrs. McMullen, then with her daughter, Susan McMullen, on their way back to Ireland, the native country of both Wadsworth and Mrs. McMullen, whose maiden name is given as Margaret Quigley. Neither of them had any intention of remaining permanently at Quebec. They put up at the same boarding house in Quebec, and after a short interval, were married. Wadsworth, in the marriage register, was described as de la ville de Quebec, or of the town of Quebec. This description was probably adopted to conform as near as possible to the rules of the church requiring a previous residence for some definite time at the place of a celebration of the marriage. After the marriage, Wadsworth proceeded to the scene of his operation on the Bonnechere, leaving his wife on the way at Hull in Lower Canada, now the province of Quebec. He continued his lumbering operations on the Bonnechere, having built a dwelling more suitable for his wife on a property in which he was interested. He sent for her and her daughter to join him. They lived together there for a number of years, where several of their children were born. At a later time, he removed with his wife and family to Aylmer in Lower Canada, where they lived for a number of years, ultimately changing his residence to Ottawa, where he died. We pick up the case several years later, as it appeared before the Privy Council Court in England. In the year 1828, an Irish immigrant, James Wadsworth, married Margaret McMullen, then a widow with a daughter by her first husband. The daughter is the present appellant. At the time of the marriage, James Wadsworth and Margaret McMullen were signatories to what is called an acte mariage under the Quebec Code. Margaret Wadsworth, the wife, died in 1872. And at the end of the same year, James Wadsworth was married for the second time to his present respondent, Dame Jane Wadsworth. And to her, he bequeathed, at his death, the whole of his estate. The contention raised by the appellant, Susan McMullen, is that the effect of the acte de mariage, entered into by James Wadsworth and his first wife, the appellant's mother, was to establish what is described in the Code Section 1260 as a legal community of goods between the consorts. If these contentions were correct, the appellant was entitled to a fourth share of all the property acquired since 1828, which James Wadsworth bequeathed to his second wife, the respondent. If, on the other hand, the international law of domicile was not affected by the code, the appellant's claim must fail. The value of property at the time of his litigation was said to be not less than £6,000 sterling. The court upheld the decision to deny the appeal and also made the appellant, Susan McMullen, pay the legal costs of the appeal.
Of course, that wasn't the only curious story concerning the webbed bliss of Mr. Wadsworth. In J.L. Gourlay's 1896 History of the Ottawa Valley, there's an equally curious anecdote. It happened in 1872 when Jimmy Wadsworth had left Eganville and had been long settled in Aylmer, Quebec. Sadly, by then, he was living as a 68-year-old widower, as his wife had just died. According to Gourlay's book, James Wadsworth, lumberer, had one daughter by his first wife. His second wife he rescued from the nunnery. She had been sent to and contrived to get him word, and between them, she made her escape, and he married her immediately. Meanwhile, back on the Bonnechere, other settlers continued to arrive and squat near Wadsworth's Eganville Ranch. Abraham Bullen, John Coyne, Roger Foy, William Jessup, and Robert Turner all arrived in a mad rush during those first 10 years after Wadsworth had established New Fairfield Farm. In fact, by 1837, John Egan had arrived and ended up buying Wadsworth's New Fairfield Farm, lock, stock, and barrel, Egan quickly went on to build a sawmill, a general store, and on the south side of the river, a grist mill. Other buildings soon followed, popping up hither and yon. Indeed, by 1845, Dewar's blacksmith shop was working exclusively for Egan, and in 1848, Harmon Moore built another Eganville dam, largely to aid Egan's grist mill. Another blacksmith named McKnight set up shop at this time to provide services to the steady stream of new immigrants and settlers who started arriving nearby. Business was so good, John Egan hired Daniel Lacey, a shoemaker who had come out from Ireland in 1847, to manage his general store. Lacey would eventually buy that store from Egan in 1854. Another shoemaker by the name of Frott would eventually arrive, and thanks be to heaven, in 1853, Eganville saw its first legal tavern open its doors to an ever-thirsty public. It was run by a happy-go-lucky fellow named Ozzie Banning. Seems appropriate now for a short break. Perhaps grab a cool, refreshing drink of water. If not, catch your breath with all the historical goings-on we've been telling you about. But don't lollygag. In no time at all, we'll be right back telling you about our very own Napoleon of the Ottawa.